I shared with some of you on every March 12th and October 21st, unless I'm in some other part of the country, I take this little pilgrimage down to Lowell to the Edson Cemetery, where I visit the grave of Jack Kerouac. March 12th is his birthday, born in 1922. October 21st is the day that he died, 1969. A little odd, perhaps, but believe me, I am not the only one going by the things that get left on his grave on those days. But when I went there this past October 21st, I found myself actually focused on the marker that's two markers over from his grave site. It may have been because I had this sermon in mind as I was going down there. For the inscription on the grave site, two markers over, reads, S.G. Sempeticatus. The S stands for Sebastian. His date of birth is March 12, 1922. His date of death is May 22, 1922. His date of death is March 12, 1944. Also on the inscription are the words PFC 51 Station Hospital. The shortened name for this young man from the Greek immigrant family was Sammy Sampas. He and Jack Kerouac were high school friends and soulmates. Much later in his life, Jack married Sammy's older sister Stella, which is how he came to be buried in their family plot, when he died at a too early age of 47. In high school, Jack Kerouac was a football and track star. His ticket out of Lowell, in fact, was a football scholarship to Columbia University, which got him to New York, and then all came after that. And in Lowell, Jack had his rough-and-tumble high school football guy friends that he liked to hang out with. He was part of the football team. But there was another side to him. There was this artistic, literary, poetic, philosophical side to the young Kerouac that also needed an outlet. And he found that in his friend, Sammy Sampas. He and Sammy and a few other like-minded Lowell High School students formed a club. And they called themselves the Young Prometheans. You got to love the name, the Young Prometheans. And they would get together and discuss art and literature and the great ideas of the day and days past. And they would share their fledgling literary efforts with one another, and they would speculate about how artistic souls like them might someday change the world that would soon be theirs. Thinking about it almost makes one want to be 18 again. Well, almost maybe. And then a war came along. A war like the world had never seen to that point, World War II. Young Promethean Jack Kerouac made two runs with the United States Merchant Marine in that war after being given a psychological discharge from the Navy. Young Promethean Sammy Sampas declared himself to be a conscientious objector, but he still volunteered to serve in combatant settings, which is how he came to be on Anzio Beach in late February of 1944 as a medic. And there he was mortally wounded and died a few days later in a military hospital. He was 21 years old. That's the same age that my son is now, with his life of promise and hope ahead. And Kerouac went on to achieve literary fame, which, tragic irony as it turned out to be, brought out his self-destructive side and his alcoholism, which brought him to his early death. But he left his mark on the American literary landscape, and his star keeps getting brighter more than ever, some 35 years after he died. And Sammy, who by most accounts had much of the same artistic and literary and intellectual resources as Kerouac, never got his chance to shine like his fellow young Promethean. He never got his chance to make good in America. That's what I mostly thought about as I stood there in the cemetery this past October 21st. What about Sammy? Maybe he too could have lit up a generation and generations after that with his literary and artistic abilities, as did his high school soulmate, who lies buried 2 grades older from him. What if Sammy Sampas had gotten his chance too? Sebastian Sampatakakis died for his country, the country that his Greek immigrant parents adopted as their own. He was 1 generation away from the home country. His name is on a war memorial at another location in Lowell. So whatever life he would have had was given up for a greater good. I struggle to say those last few words. That's got nothing to do with my throat. Give it up for a greater good. I struggle hard, in fact. And yet, I believe him. I'm a child of the war in which Sammy served, as did my father and my uncle and countless others, some of whose names I know, most I don't. And whether they came home safely to live out their lives, or whether, like Sammy, they lost their lives on the cusp of adulthood, I firmly believe that I would not have lived out the life that has been mine to live for the past 6 decades if the horrifying events in Europe of the late 30s and early 40s had been allowed to continue unchecked. But my personal life is not the greater good to which I refer. I have a strong ego, but it's not quite that bloated. It's just that I do believe there are times when the values and the principles and the traditions of this nation, even when we acknowledge all the ways, the many, many ways in which we have fallen tragically short of those values, and also the safety and well-being of its citizens, there are times when that comes to the fore, and I believe does call upon a nation to be defended by force. And very simply put, that's the criteria I see for taking a nation into war, and only doing so after all other possible means of achieving the same objectives have been thoroughly exhausted. For we know there are a myriad of ways to maintain and extend the values that represent the best of who we are as a nation. And there are myriads of ways to protect the lives of our citizens, well short of going to war. Which is why going to war for such reasons is always and always should be an absolute last resort. To expand upon this point a bit, I want to go back and look at the years that immediately followed the Second World War. I recently, as some of you know, put out a book, which I celebrate. Some of the lives and the creative energies of those who constituted what passed as a counterculture in America during the 1950s, called the Beat Generation. And in that book, I get a little sharp in my critique of that era in certain places, taking a task here and there. And this was the era that was presided over by the man who also conducted the American and the Allied effort of World War II, General and then President Dwight Eisenhower. This morning, however, as I look back at that time from the events of the present, I think I need to give that man his deserved due. For Mr. Eisenhower served as a president at a time when the nation's fear of communism was at its height and was being greatly exacerbated by the treachery of Senator Joseph McCarthy. And there were a number of potential explosive situations the president had to confront in the course of his presidency. Closing of the Suez Canal, the defeat of the French, Vietnam, Dien Bien Phu, communist takeover of Hungary, to name 3. I was a child, but I can sort of remember those things. And when you think about the climate of fear that we were under then, because I can remember as a grade school kid, duck and cover air raid drills. We had to walk out in the hall and curl up against the sides of walls as if somehow that was going to protect us if a bomb Never got dropped on St. Albans, West Virginia, but there we were. Remembering that aura of fear. Mr. Eisenhower could very well have played on that fear to send American troops into battle in any of those places I just mentioned with far more justification, I might add, than the so-called rationales now offered for the morass we're in at the moment. Well, I certainly make no claim to knowing the workings of President Eisenhower's mind during these times I just mentioned, but I think I got a pretty good idea as to why no American troops were committed during those crises and why, as a result, no American lives were lost. I've been willing to bet it was because, as a general in World War II, Mr. Eisenhower knew up close and personal what it meant to ask someone to die for their country. He knew what it was like in the hours before the D-Day invasion to walk among the ranks of those he was sending into battle and look them in the eye, knowing it was only a matter of hours or days before many of them would be dead. Such an experience would certainly give a president pause, I would think, before asking young soldiers for their supreme sacrifice. Mr. Eisenhower was our last president we've had to have known such experience. Think of the wars in which lives have been lost since that time. And I cannot help but compare this experience of General and President Eisenhower to that of another American president who could not walk out the front door of his vacation residence and tell a mother why your son had to die in Iraq. And you can talk about Cindy Sheehan's motivations, and you can talk about whatever organization she's working in concert with, but I still think she's framing the right and crucial question. Is this a conflict which warrants young men and women being asked to give up their lives for? Is there enough at stake here to ask for such a thing? Well, between what I've said from this pulpit already and from some of my public statements beyond this pulpit, I think my feelings about the current war in which we are enmeshed are pretty well known. I continue to hold them as strongly as ever, but I will not unduly belabor them today. While the president clings to his rhetoric of completing the mission and staying the course, the more recognized and realized challenge now, I think, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear and minds to comprehend, is how to remove ourselves from this horribly tragic situation with minimal loss of life and limb, and leave behind at least some measure of stability in a country which I feel we have needlessly invaded. And some of us are working to organize a community forum in the early part of next year that will get at these issues, we hope. You can talk to me, you can talk to Roy Goodman, who led our chalice this morning, if you're interested in helping plan for such a conversation, because I think it's one that needs to take place among our citizenry now in this country and across the nation, whatever their thoughts and persuasions may be about the conduct of this war. For today, I'm going to heed the distinction made by Senator John Kerry between war and warrior, realizing there's a part of me that resists the term warrior. I'll also set that semantic issue aside. This weekend began with a holiday observance for those who served their country in the military, both those who perished in that service and those who returned. And it is right and good that we do this. For these persons, whatever the nature of their service and whatever the situation in which they served, have preserved the principle that there are values and ideals, along with the safety and well-being of the citizenry, that are worth preserving, and that do transcend the needs and the desires and the aspirations of the self. And I think the real tragedy of war, even greater than the loss of life it entails, is when that principle is misused or abused by those who would take a nation into war, which is the real tragedy, I believe, we are confronting right now. Still more than ever, then, we must honor the lives that have so recently been lost and the lives that have been damaged, as well as the lives of the citizens of Iraq who probably still don't quite know what's hit them. We should honor those lives, first of all, for their intrinsic value, for their inherent worth and dignity, which each of us possess, just as they did. We should honor them for all they meant to those who knew and loved them. And if their sacrifice now, and in days to come, gives us the same kind of pause that I feel stayed the hand of a former president who could have taken us into war on more than one occasion and did not. And if their sacrifice serves at some time in the future to pull us back from the brink of another headlong rush into an ill-conceived conflict, then they will have indeed served their country all the more. I don't feel the need to go much beyond this right now, other than to offer this closing thought. The final scene in the movie Saving Private Ryan, which we ran over this past weekend, I believe, is one that has stayed with me far beyond the storyline and the depictions of the horrors of war. It takes place, maybe you watched it over this weekend, I don't know, but it takes place in the present day as an aging James Ryan returns to Omaha Beach and to the scene of the battles of his youth, and now he's got his wife and his children and his grandchildren all kind of walking along and behind him. He walks through this immense cemetery of crosses and Stars of David, seeing acres and acres of graves of young men who did not get to live out the life that he did. And he turns to his wife and he says, "Tell me I have lived a good life." And that one scene captures as well as anything I know, and certainly well beyond anything I've had to say today, what it means to ask someone to die for their country. It means they do not even get the chance to raise the question of whether or not they've lived a good, full, and complete life. For it is in the silent presence of all those who were denied that chance that the elderly James Ryan says, "Tell me, I've lived a good life." I think of that scene as I see the body count go up by a few more numbers each day or week. For each number represents yet another man or woman who, no doubt having lived good lives for the short time they had them, are still being denied the knowledge of how well those lives could have been lived in the fullness of their time. So here we are, with the lives that continue to be given us, and with all the opportunities that this sacred gift of life holds for us for as long as it is ours to hold. And part of living a good life includes finding and upholding that blessed and holy spirit of life that is within all of us. And it means continuing, however discouraging the odds may seem at times, to make the blessings of life and the blessings of love and hope and peace and justice as available as you can for all of the world's people, people as close as the person next to you, and as far away as the far reaches of our very fragile planet. It was Mahatma Gandhi who once said, "Whatever you do may seem insignificant, but it's very important that you do it anyway." Whatever we can each do to inch us a little closer to the day when all the peoples of this earth can look back upon a life well lived, it's very important that we do that. Let's sing together number 131.